of Soviet aircraft leaves Kola. We ought to know about it. What's real time? The CAG asked. They didn't tell me that. Submarine. Baker smiled thinly. Jesus protect him when he transmits. Well, Ivan sent his bombers against Iceland yesterday. Anybody wonder where they'll be coming today? In case anyone wants it, my official intelligence estimate is right here, Toland said. Always nice to have a professional opinion, the CAG observed acidly. We ought to head north and pound on those Russians. By training and experience, the CAG was an attack pilot. But we can't do that until we deal with the backfires. What is the strength of the threat to us? I'm assuming no assistance from the Air Force units. With Soviet naval aviation alone, we have 6 regiments of strike aircraft, 3 each of backfires and badgers, 1 regiment of badger jammers, 1 regiment of bear reconnaissance birds. Add some tanker assets to that. 27 aircraft to the regiment. That's about 160 strike aircraft, each of which can carry 2 or 3 air-to-surface missiles. Those badgers will have to stretch to get here. The round trip must be a good 4,000 miles, even if they cut across Norway. Those are tired old birds, CAG said. What about their satellites? Toland checked his watch. There will be a Rorsat pass over us in 52 minutes. They got us 12 hours ago, too. I hope the Air Force gets its act together with their ASAT pretty soon, Svensson said quietly. If Ivan can real-time that satellite intelligence, they don't need those damn bears. They can figure our course easily enough, and it's only a 4-hour cruise down here for them. Try a course change as it passes overhead? CAG wondered. Not much point in it, Baker replied. We've been heading east for 10 hours. They can't miss that, and we can only do 20 knots. We can give them a plus-minus of 80 miles. How long does it take to fly that? Toland noted that Svensson and the CAG didn't like that decision, but neither disputed the point. He'd been told that Baker wasn't a man to argue with, and wondered if that was a good trait in a combat commander. Hill 152, Iceland. Edwards took some solace in having predicted the cold front's arrival properly. The rain had come exactly on time, just after midnight. If there was anything to make the worst situation worse still, it was a steady, cold rain. The showers were intermittent now, a ceiling of gray clouds 2,000 feet over their heads, blown along by 30-knot winds toward Iceland's mountainous center. "Where are the fighters?" Edwards asked. He swept Reykjavik Airport with his binoculars, but couldn't find the 6 fighters he'd reported on the previous evening. All the transports were gone also. He saw 1 Soviet helicopter and some tanks. There was very little traffic on the streets and roads he could see. Certainly not much for a Monday morning. Surely the commercial fishermen would be driving to their boats. Anybody see them lift out? No, sir. Weather we had last night, the whole Russian Air Force could have come in and left. Sergeant Smith was annoyed, too, mainly with the weather. Could be in those hangars, maybe. About 2300 the previous night, they'd observed a streak of light like that of a rocket taking off. But whatever it had been aimed at had been lost in a rain shower. Edwards had not reported that, halfway wondering if it might have been lightning. What's that? That's no tank. Garcia, check it out. 500 yards west of the terminal. The lieutenant handed the glasses over. Okay. That's some kind of tracked vehicle. Looks like it has some sort of... not a gun, there's 3 of them. Rocket launcher, maybe. Sam's, the sergeant commented. How much you want to bet that's what we saw shut off last night? E.T., phone home. Edward started putting his radio together. How many launchers and what type? Doghouse asked. We see 1 launcher, possibly 3 missiles on it. We can't tell the type. I wouldn't know the difference anyway. They might have fired off a missile last night about 2300 local. Why the hell didn't you tell us? Doghouse demanded. "'Cause I didn't know what it was,' Edwards nearly yelled. "'God damn it, we're reporting on everything we see, and you don't even believe half of what we tell you.' "'Settle down, Beagle. We believe you. I know it's hard. Anything else happening?' "'He knows it's hard,' Edwards told his men. "'Can't see much activity at all, Doghouse. Still early, but we'd expect civilian traffic on the streets.' "'Copy that. Okay now, Edwards, real fast. What's your father's middle name?' "'Doesn't have one,' Edwards said. "'What? The name of his boat?' "'The Annie J. What the hell is this? What happened to your girlfriend, Sandy?' It was like a knife in the guts. The tone of his voice answered for him. "'You go and fuck yourself!' "'Copy that,' the voice replied. "'Sorry, Lieutenant, but you had to pass that test. We have no further orders for you yet. Tell you the truth, nobody's decided what to do about you. Stay cool and avoid contact. Same transmission schedule. If you get tagged and they try to make you play radio games, start off every transmission with our call sign and say that everything is going great. Got that? Going great. Roger. If you hear me say that, you know something's wrong. Out. Keflavik, Iceland. The major commanding the Air Force detachment was enjoying himself, despite having been up for over 30 hours. Keflavik was a magnificent base, and the paratroopers had captured it nearly intact. Most importantly, the Americans had thoughtfully stored their maintenance equipment in protective shelters dispersed throughout the base, and all of it had survived. As he watched from the smashed control tower, a half-dozen sweeper trucks were brushing the last fragments from Runway 9. In 30 minutes it would be safe to use. 8 fuel bowsers sat filled and ready on the field, and by the end of the day the pipeline should be repaired. Then this would be a fully functional Soviet airbase. How long before our fighters arrive?
30 minutes, Comrade Major.
Get the radar operating. The Soviets had packed most of the equipment for a forward airbase in one of the Fusik's barges. A mobile long-range radar was now operating just west of the main runway intersection, plus a van from which ground controllers could direct radar intercepts of incoming targets. 3 truck vans of spare parts and air-to-air missiles were on the base, and 300 maintenance personnel had been flown in the previous day. A full battery of SA-11 missiles guarded the runways, plus 8 mobile anti-aircraft guns and a platoon of infantrymen armed with handheld SAMs for low-flying raiders. The only hang-up had been with the SAMs, and the replacements flown in a few hours ago had already been loaded on the launcher vehicles. Any NATO aircraft that came waltzing into Iceland was in for a rude surprise, as a Royal Air Force Jaguar had discovered the night before, shot out of the sky over Reykjavik before its pilot could react.
Runway 9 is cleared for operation, the radio operator reported.
Excellent! Now get them working on 1-8. I want every strip operational by this afternoon.
Hill 152, Iceland.
What's that?
Edwards saw it first for a change.
The wide silver wings of a Badger bomber skirted in and out of the lower cloud layer. Then something else. It was smaller, and it disappeared back into the clouds.
Was that a fighter?
I didn't see anything, sir.
Garcia had been looking in the wrong direction. The sound passed overhead, the distinctive whine of turbojets on a low throttle setting.
The lieutenant was becoming a master at getting his radio in operation.
Doghouse, this is Beagle, and things are rotten. Do you copy?
Roger, Beagle. What do you have for us?
We have aircraft flying overhead, westbound, probably for Keflavik. Stand by.
I can hear 'em, but I don't see nothing.
Garcia handed the glasses over.
I saw 1 twin-engine aircraft, probably a bomber, and 1 other aircraft a lot smaller, like a fighter. We have aircraft sounds overhead, but we got solid clouds at about 2,000 feet. No more visual sightings.
You say heading towards Keflavik?
That's a firm. The bomber appeared to be westbound and descending.
Any chance you can walk back to Keflavik to see what's happening there?
Edwards didn't speak for a second. Couldn't the bastard read a map? That meant walking 30 miles over bare ground.
Negative. Say again, negative. No chance. Over.
Understood, Beagle. Sorry about that. I had orders to ask. Get back to us when you have a better count. You're doing good, guys. Hang in there. Out.
They asked if we wanted to walk over to Keflavik, Edwards announced as he took off his headset.
I said no.
Real good, sir, Smith observed.
At least Air Force officers weren't total idiots.
Keflavik, Iceland. The first MiG-29 Fulcrum landed at Keflavik a minute later. It taxied behind a base jeep and stopped close to the tower. The major in command of the base was there to meet it.
Welcome to Keflavik.
Excellent. Find me a lavatory, the colonel replied. The major motioned him to his own jeep. The Americans had left 70 jeeps behind, plus over 300 private automobiles, and drove toward the tower. The American radios had been destroyed, but the plumbing was made of sterner stuff.
How many?
6, the colonel answered.
A goddamned Norwegian F-16 jumped us off Hammerfest and got one before we knew he was there. Another aborted with engine trouble, and the third had to land at Akureyri.
Do we have men there?
Not yet. We have only one helicopter. More should be coming in today.
They pulled to the door.
Inside, second door on the right.
Thank you, Comrade Major.
The colonel was back in 3 minutes. The unglamorous side of flying fighter aircraft. Somehow we never warn our cadets about this. Here, coffee. The previous occupants were most kind to us. The major unscrewed an American thermos. The colonel took the cup, savoring the flavor as though it were fine brandy, while he watched his fighters land. We have your missiles all ready for you, and we can refuel every aircraft from our trucks. How soon can you fly again? I'd prefer that my men get at least 2 hours to rest and eat, and I want those aircraft dispersed after they're fueled. Have you been hit yet?
Only 2 reconnaissance aircraft, and we killed one. If we're lucky,
luck is for fools. The Americans will hit us today.
I would.
USS Nimitz. We have a new intel source on Iceland, codenamed Beagle, Toland reported. They were in the carrier's combat information center now. He counted over 80 transport flights into Reykjavik last night, at least 6 fighters with them. That's enough airlift capacity for a whole airborne division and then some. Doghouse in Scotland says that they have an unconfirmed report of Soviet fighters landing now.
Have to be a long-range one. Foxhound, maybe a Fulcrum, Cag said.
If they have them to spare.
Well, we weren't planning to visit the place just yet. We might have a problem with them trying raid escort, though.
Any word on E3 support from the UK? Baker asked Svensson.
Looks like none.
Toland, when do you expect our friends to arrive?
The Rorsat passes overhead in 20 minutes. They'll probably want that data before they take off.
They could take off at any time after that, Admiral. If the backfires, tank up partway down and proceed at max power 2 hours. That's worst case. More likely 4 to 5 hours.
Cag?
The air group commander looked tense. Each carrier has a Hummer radar bird up, a pair of F-14 Tomcats with each. 2 more Tomcats on the catapults, ready to go at 5 minutes' notice. Another Hummer and a tanker. The rest of the fighters are at plus 15 on the roof, loaded and fueled. The flight crews are briefed. 1 prowler over the formation, the rest ready to go at 15. The A-7s have buddy stores rigged. We're ready. Foch has her Crusaders at plus 15. Good birds, but short legs. When the time comes, we'll use them for overhead coverage. Kirovsk, RSFSR. The radar ocean reconnaissance satellite, called a RORSAT, passed over the formation at 0310. Its radar transmitter noted the formation, and its cameras tracked in on their wakes. 5 minutes later, the data was in Moscow.
15 minutes after that, flight crews were given their final brief at 4 military air bases grouped around the city of Kirovsk on the Kola Peninsula. The crews were quiet, no less tense than their American targets. Both sides mulled over the same thoughts. This was the exercise both sides had practiced for over 15 years. Millions of hours of planning, studies, and simulations were about to be put to the test. The Badgers lifted off first, pushed by their twin Mikulin engines. Each takeoff was an effort. The bombers were so heavily loaded that the tower controllers reached out with their minds to wish every aircraft into the still morning air. Once off the ground, they headed north, forming up into loose regimental formations just north of Murmansk, before heading west and skirting past the North Cape, before their slow left turns took them toward the North Atlantic. 20 miles off the North Russian coast, USS Narwhal hovered beneath the surface of a slate-gray sea. The quietest submarine in the U.S. fleet, she was a specialized intelligence-gathering platform that spent more time on the Soviet coast than did some ships in the Russian Navy. Her three thin ESM antennae were raised, as was a million-dollar search periscope. Technicians aboard listened in on low-power radio conversations between aircraft as they formed up. Three uniformed intelligence specialists and a civilian from the National Security Agency evaluated the strength of the raid and decided that it was large enough to risk a warning broadcast. An additional mast was raised and aimed at a communication satellite 24,000 miles away. The burst transmission lasted less than a 15th of a second. USS Nimitz. The message was automatically relayed to four separate communication stations, and within 30 seconds was at Sacklant headquarters. 5 minutes after that, Toland had the yellow message form in his hand. He walked immediately to Admiral Baker and handed the message over. 0418 Zulu real-time sends warning air raid takeoff 0400 heading west from Kola, estimate 5 regiment plus. Baker checked his watch. Fast work. Cag? The air group commander looked at the form and walked to a phone. Shoot off the plus fives. Recall the patrol aircraft when they get to station, and set up 2 more Tomcats and a Hummer on plus five. I want the returning aircraft turned around immediately. Reserve 1 catapult for tankers. He came back. With your permission, sir, I propose to put another pair of F-14s and another Hummer up in an hour, and put all the fighters on plus five. At 0600, the rest of the fighters go up with tankers in support. We'll meet them with everything we have about 200 miles out and kick their ass. Very well. Comments? Svensson looked pensively at the master plot. Circles were already being drawn for the farthest possible advance of the Soviet bombers. The Brits get the same warning? Yes, sir, Toland answered. Norwegians, too. With luck, one or the other might make contact with the raid and nibble at it some, maybe put a trailer with them. Nice idea, but don't count on it. If I was running the attack, I'd come way west and turn south right over Iceland. Svensson looked back at the plot. You think real-time would have broadcast a warning for Bear D's? My information, sir, is that they are allowed to broadcast only for 3 regiments or more. 10 or 20 bears wouldn't be enough. They might not even notice. So, right now we probably have a herd of bears out there not emitting anything, just flying around listening for our radar signals. Toland nodded agreement. The battle group was a circle of ships with a radius of 30 miles. The carriers and troop ships in the center, surrounded by 9 missile-armed escorts and 6 more specialized anti-submarine ships. None of the ships had a radar transmitter working. Instead, they got all their electronic information from the 2 circling E-2C air surveillance aircraft, known colloquially as Hummers, whose radars swept a circle over 400 miles across. The drama being played out was more complex than the most intricate game. More than a dozen variable factors could interact, with their permutations running into the thousands. Radar detection range depended on altitude and consequent distance to the horizon that neither eyes nor radar can see past. An aircraft could avoid, or at least delay, detection by skimming the waves. But this carried severe penalties in fuel consumption and range. They had to locate the battle group without being detected by it first. The Russians knew where the carrier group was, but it would move in the 4 hours required for the bombers to get there. Their missiles needed precise information if they were to home in on the raid's primary target, the 2 American and 1 French carrier, or the mission was a wasted effort. Putting the group's fighters on station to intercept the incoming raid depended on expert prognostication of its direction and speed. Their job? To locate and engage the bombers before they could find the carriers. For both sides, the fundamental choice was whether or not to radiate, to use their radar transmitters. Either choice carried benefits and dangers, and there was no best solution to the problem. Nearly every American ship carried powerful air search radars that could locate the raid 200 or more miles away. But those radar signals could be detected at an even greater range, generating a return signal that would potentially allow the Soviets to circle the formation, pinpoint it, then converge in from all points of the compass. The game was hide-and-seek, played over 1 million square miles of ocean. The losers died. North Atlantic. The Soviet Bear D reconnaissance bombers were passing south of Iceland. There were 10 of them, covering a front of 1,000 miles. The monstrous propeller-driven aircraft were packed full of electronics gear and crewed by men with years of training and experience in locating the American carrier groups. At the nose, tail, and wingtips, sensitive antennae were already reaching out, searching for the signals from American radar transmitters. They would close on those signals, chart them with great care, but remain forever outside the estimated detection radius. Their greatest fear was that the Americans would use no radar at all, or that they would switch their sets on and off at random intervals and locations, which posed the danger of the Bears blundering directly into armed ships and aircraft. The Bear had 20 hours of endurance, but the penalty for it was virtually no combat capability. It was too slow to run from an interceptor, and had no ability to fight one. "We have located the enemy battle force," the crew's bitter joke ran. "Do svidaniya, Rodina!" But they were a proud group of professionals. The attack bombers depended on them, as did their country. 800 miles north of Iceland, the Badgers altered their course to 180, due south at 500 knots. They had avoided the still dangerous Norwegians, and it was not thought that the British would reach this far out. These air crews kept a nervous watch out their windows, nevertheless, their own electronic sensors fully operative and under constant scrutiny. An attack by tactical fighters against Iceland was expected at any time, and the bomber crews knew that any NATO fighter pilot worthy of his name would instantly jettison his bomb load for a chance at air-to-air combat with so helpless a target as a 20-year-old Badger. They had reached the end of their useful lives. Cracks were developing in the wings. The turbine blades in their jet engines were worn, reducing performance and fuel efficiency. 200 miles behind them, the backfire bombers were finishing their refueling operations. The Tu-22Ms had been accompanied by tankers, and after topping off their tanks, they headed south, slightly west of the Badger's course track. With an AS-6 Kingfish missile hanging under each wing, the backfires, too, were potentially vulnerable. But the backfire had the ability to run at high Mach numbers and stood a fair chance at survival, even in the face of determined fighter opposition. Their crews were the elite of Soviet naval aviation, well-paid and pampered by Soviet society, their commanders had reminded them at the regimental briefings. Now it was time to deliver. All 3 groups of aircraft came south at optimum cruise speed, their flight crews monitoring fuel consumption, engine heat, and many other gauges for the long overwater flight.
USS Nimitz.
Toland stepped outside for a breath of air. It was a fine morning, the cotton ball clouds overhead turning briefly pink from the sunrise. Saratoga and Foch were visible on the horizon, perhaps 8 miles away, their size impressive even at this distance. Closer in, Ticonderoga was cutting through the 5-foot seas, white-painted missiles visible on her twin launchers. A few blinker lights traded signals. Otherwise, the ships in view were gray shapes without noise, waiting. Nimitz's deck was covered with aircraft. F-14 Tomcat interceptors sat everywhere. Two were hooked up on the midship's catapults, only 100 feet from him, their two-man flight crews dozing. The fighters carried Phoenix long-range missiles. The attack bombers carried Buddy store tanks instead of weapons. They'd be used to refuel the fighters in flight, enabling them to remain aloft an extra 2 hours. Deck crewmen in multicolored shirts scurried about, checking and rechecking the aircraft. The carrier began turning to port, coming around into the westerly wind in preparation for launching aircraft. He checked his watch. 0558. Time to get back to CIC. The carrier would go to general quarters in 2 minutes. The intelligence watch officer took one more breath of fresh sea air and wondered if it would be his last.
North Atlantic.
Contact, the technician said over the bear's interphone. Signals indicate an American airborne radar transmitter carrier type.
Give me a bearing, the pilot commanded.
Patience, Comrade Major.
The technician made an adjustment on his board. His radio interferometers timed the signals as they arrived at antennae arrayed all over the aircraft.
Southeast. Bearing to signal is 131. Signal strength 1. He is quite distant. Bearing is not changing as yet. I recommend we maintain a constant course for the present.
The pilot and co-pilot exchanged a look, but no words.
Somewhere off to their left was an American E-2C Hawkeye radar aircraft. A flight crew of 2, a radar intercept officer, and 2 radar operators. It could manage the air battle for over 100 enemy aircraft, could vector a missile-armed interceptor in at them within seconds of detection. The pilot wondered just how accurate his information was on the Hawkeye's radar. What if they had already detected his bear? He knew the answer to that. His first warning would come when he detected the fire control radar of an American F-14 Tomcat heading right at him. The bear held course 180 while the plotting officer tracked the change in bearing to the radar signal. In 10 minutes, they might just have an accurate fix. If they lived that long. They would not break radio silence until they had a fix.
I have it, the plotting officer reported. Estimate distance to contact is 650 kilometers. Position 47 degrees 9 minutes north, 34 degrees 50 minutes west.
Get it out, the pilot ordered.
A directional HF antenna in the aircraft's tail fin turned within its housing and radioed the information to the raid commander, whose Bear Command aircraft was 100 miles behind the snoopers. The raid commander compared this datum with that from the reconnaissance satellite. Now he had 2 pieces of information. The American's position 3 hours ago was 60 miles south of the estimated plot for the Hawkeye. The Americans probably had 2 of them up, northeast and northwest of the formation. That was normal fleet doctrine. So the carrier group was right about here. The Badgers were heading right for it. They would encounter the American radar coverage in 2 hours.
Good, he said to himself. Everything is going according to plan.
USS Nimitz.
Toland watched the aircraft plot in silence. The radar picture from the Hawkeyes was being transmitted to the carrier by digital radio link, enabling the battle group commander to follow everything. The same data went to the group air defense boss on Ticonderoga,
and every other ship fitted with the Naval Tactical Data System. That included the French ships, which had long since been equipped to operate closely with the U.S. Navy. So far, there was nothing to be seen except the tracks of American military and commercial aircraft ferrying men and supplies across the ocean, and dependents back to the States. These were beginning to swing south. Warned that an air battle was possible, the pilots of DC-10s and C-5As were prudently keeping out of the way, even if it meant having to land and refuel on the way to their destinations. The group's 48 Tomcat interceptors were now mostly on station, spread in a line 300 miles across. Each pair of Tomcats had a tanker aircraft in attendance. The attack birds, Corsairs and Intruders, carried oversized fuel tanks with refueling drogues attached. And one by one, the Tomcats were already beginning to top off their fuel tanks from them. Soon the Corsairs began returning to their carriers for refills. They could keep this up for hours. The aircraft remaining on the carriers were spotted on the decks for immediate takeoff. If a raid came in, they would be shot off the catapults at once to eliminate the fire hazard inherent in any type of aircraft. Toland had seen all this before, but could not fail to be amazed by it. Everything was going as smoothly as a ballet. The aircraft loitered at their patrol stations, tracing lazy, fuel-efficient circles in the sky. The carriers were racing east now at 30 knots to make up the distance lost during launch operations. The Marines' landing ships, Saipan, Ponce, and Newport, could make only about 20 knots, and were essentially defenseless. East of the group, carrier S-3A Viking and landing-based P-3C Orion anti-submarine aircraft were patrolling for Soviet submarines. They reported to the group ASW commander on the destroyer Caron. There was as yet nothing for anyone to direct his frustration against. The old story known to all fighting men. You wait. North Atlantic. The raid commander was rapidly accumulating data. He now had positions on four American Hawkeyes. The first two had barely been plotted when the second pair had showed up, outside and south of the first. The Americans had unwittingly given him a very accurate picture of where the battle group was, and the steady eastward drift of the Hawkeyes gave him course and speed. His bears were now in a wide semicircle around the Americans, and the Badgers were 30 miles north of American radar cover, 400 miles north of the estimated location of the ships. Send to Group A. Enemy formation at grid coordinates 456-810, speed 20, course 100. Execute attack plan A at 06:15 Zulu time. Send the same to Group B. Tactical control of Group B switches to Team East Coordinator. The battle had begun. The Badger crews exchanged looks of relief. They had detected the American radar signals 15 minutes before, and knew that each kilometer south meant a greater chance that they would run into a cloud of enemy fighters. Aboard each aircraft, the navigator and bombardier worked quickly to feed strike information into the Kelt missiles slung under each wing. 800 miles to their southwest, the backfire crews advanced their throttle slightly, plotting a course to the datum point supplied by the raid commander. Having circled far around the American formation, they would now be controlled by the strike officer aboard the first Bear to make electronic contact with the Hawkeyes. They had a solid fix on the NATO formation, but they needed better if they were to locate and engage the carriers. These crews were not relieved, but excited. Now came the challenging part. The battle plan had been formulated a year before and practiced, over land exclusively, 5 times. 4 times it had worked. Aboard 80 Badger bombers, pilots checked their watches, counting off the seconds to 06:15 Zulu. Launch! The lead Badger launched 8 seconds early. First one, then the second aircraft-shaped Kelt, dropped free of its pylon, falling several hundred feet before their turbojet engines ran up to full power.
Running on autopilot, the Celts climbed back to 30,000 feet and cruised on south at 600 knots indicated airspeed. The bomber crews watched their birds proceed for a minute or two. Then each of the bombers turned slowly and gracefully for home, their mission done. 6 Badger J standoff jamming aircraft continued south. They would stay 60 kilometers behind the Celts. Their crews were nervous but confident. It would not be easy for American radar to burn through their powerful jammers, and in any case the Americans would soon have many targets to concern them. The Celts continued on, straight and level. They carried their own electronic equipment, which would be triggered automatically by sensors in their tail fins. When they entered the theoretical arc of the Hawkeye's radar range, transponders in their noses clicked on. USS Nimitz. Radar contacts. Designate Raid 1, bearing 349er, range 460 miles. Numerous contacts. Count 140 contacts, course 175, speed 600 knots. The master tactical scope plotted the contacts electronically, and a pair of plexiglass plates showed another visual display.
"So, here they come," Baker said quietly. "Right on time. Comments?"
Toland didn't get a chance. The computer display went white. "Clipper Base, this is Hawk 3. We're getting some jamming," reported the senior airborne control officer. "We plot 6, possibly 7 jammers, bearing 340 to 030. Pretty powerful stuff. Estimate we have standoff jammers, but no escort jammers. Contacts are lost for the present. Estimate burn through in 10 minutes. Request weapons free and release to vector intercepts." Baker looked over to his air operations officer.
"Let's get things started."
Air Ops nodded and picked up a microphone. "Hawk 3, this is Clipper Base. Weapons free. I say again, weapons are free. Release authority is granted. Splash me some bombers. Out."
Svensson frowned at the display. "Admiral, we're coming about to clear decks. Recommend the formation stays together now." He got a nod.
"Clipper Fleet, this is Clipper Base. Come left to 270. Launch all remaining aircraft. Execute." On the single command, the formation made a 180-degree left turn. Those ships that did not as yet have missiles on their launchers rectified this. Fire control radars were trained north but kept in standby mode. 30 different captains waited for the word to activate. North Atlantic. She was pissed off. Sure, she thought, I'm good enough to fly. I'm good enough to be an instructor pilot for the Eagle. Engineering test pilot. Assistant project officer for the ASAT program. I'm good enough to get an invite to Houston, even. But will they let me fly combat? No, there's a war going on, and I'm nothing but a goddamned ferry pilot. Shit. Her name was Amy Nakamura. She was a major United States Air Force, with 3,000 hours of jet time, two-thirds of it in F-15s. Short and stocky, like many fighter pilots, only her father had ever called her beautiful. He also called her Bunny. When her fellow pilots found that one out, they shortened it to Buns. She and 3 men were ferrying 4 brand-new Eagle fighters to Germany, where others, men, would get to use them properly. They each carried fast-pack conformal fuel tanks to make the trip in one long hop, and for self-defense, a single Sidewinder missile, plus their usual load of 20-millimeter cannon shells. The Russians let women fly combat in World War II, she thought. A couple even made ace. "Hey, Buns, check your 3 o'clock, called her wing man. Nakamura had phenomenal eyesight, but she could scarcely believe it. "Tell me what you see, Butch." "Badgers? Fucking TU-16 Badgers. Tally-ho, where's the Navy supposed to be?" "Close. Try and raise 'em, Buns." "Navy Task Force, this is Air Force Ferry Flight Gulf 4 Niner.
We are eastbound with 4 Foxtrot 15s. We have a visual on a Russian bomber formation position.
Shit, do you read? Over.
Who the hell is that? A Hawkeye crewman asked aloud.
The communications technician answered.
Golf 4-9er, we need authentication. November 4 Whiskey.
This could be a Russian playing radio games.
Major Nakamura swore to herself as she ran her finger down the list of communication codes.
There.
Alpha 6 Hotel.
Golf 4-9er, this is Navy Hawk 1. Say your position.
Warning, we are calling in the clans on those badgers.
You'd better get clear. Acknowledge.
Like hell, Navy. I got visual on 3+ badgers northbound. Position 49 north, 33 east.
Northbound? The intercept officer said.
Golf, this is Hawk 1. Confirm your visual. Say again your visual.
Hawk 1, this is Golf. I now have a dozen badgers. Say again, Tango Uniform 1-6, bombers visual. South of my position, heading towards me and closing fast. We are engaging. Out.
Nothing on radar, boss, the radar operator said. That's way the hell north of here.
Then what the hell is he talking about?
Major Amelia Buns Nakamura reached down without looking to toggle up her missile and head-up display to tactical. Then she flipped the switch for her air intercept radar. Her IFF system interrogated the target as a possible friendly and came up blank. That was enough.
Frank, take your element east. Butch, follow me. Everybody watch your fuel states. Charge!
The Badger pilots were a little too relaxed, now that the most dangerous part of their mission was behind them. They didn't spot the 4 American fighters until they were less than a mile away, their robin's egg blue paint blending them in perfectly with the clear morning sky.
Buns selected her cannon for the first pass and triggered 200 rounds into the cockpit of a Badger. The twin-engine bomber went instantly out of control and rolled over like a dead whale.
One.
The Major howled with delight, pulled the Eagle up into a 5G loop, then over to dive on the next target. The Soviets were alerted now, and the second Badger attempted to dive away. It had not the slightest chance. Nakamura fired her sidewinder from a range of less than a mile and watched the missile trace all the way into the Badger's left side engine and blast the wing right off the airplane.
Two.
Another Badger was 3 miles ahead.
Patience, she told herself. You have a big speed advantage.
She nearly forgot that the Russian bomber had tail guns. A Soviet sergeant reminded her of it, missing, but scaring the hell out of her. The Eagle jerked in a 6G turn to the left and closed on a parallel course before turning in. The next burst from her cannon exploded the Badger in midair, and she had to dive to avoid the wreckage. The engagement lasted all of 90 seconds, and she was wringing wet with perspiration.
Butch, where are you?
I got one.
Buns, I got one.
The Eagle pulled up alongside. Nakamura looked around. Suddenly, the sky was clear. Where had they all gone?
Navy Hawk 1, this is Golf. Do you read? Over.
Roger, Golf.
Okay, Navy. We just smoked 4. Repeat 4 Badgers for you.
Make that 5, Buns, the other element leader called in.
Something's wrong, sir.
The radar operator on Hawk 1 motioned to his scope.
We have these buggers just popped through, and they say they bagged some, gotta be 300-400 miles away.
Clipper Base, this is Hawk 1. We just had contact with an Air Force ferry flight eastbound. They claim they just splashed 5 Badgers northbound several 100 miles north of us. Say again, northbound.
Tolan's eyebrows went up.
Probably some had to abort, Baker observed. This is close to their fuel limit, isn't it?
Yes, sir, replied Air Ops.
He didn't look happy with his own answer.
Burn through, announced the radar operator. We have reacquired the targets.
The Celts had flown on, oblivious to the furor around them. Their radar transponders made them look like 110-foot Badgers. Their own white noise jammers came on, somewhat obscuring them yet again on the radar scopes, and autopilot controls began to jerk them up, down, left, right,
in 100-meter leaps as an aircraft might do when trying to avoid a missile. The Celts had been real missiles once, but on retirement from frontline service 6 years earlier, their warheads had been replaced with additional fuel tankage, and they had been relegated to a role as target drones, a purpose they were serving admirably now.
Tally-ho!
The first squadron of 12 Tomcats was now 150 miles away. The Celts showed up perfectly on radar, and the intercept officers in the back seat of each fighter quickly established target tracks. The Celts were approaching what would have been nominal missile launch distance, if they were the bombers everyone thought they were. The Tomcats launched a volley of million-dollar AIM-54C Phoenix missiles at a range of 140 miles. The missiles blazed in on their targets at Mach 5, directed by the fighters' targeting radars. In under a minute, the 48 missiles had killed 39 targets. The first squadron broke clear as the second came into launch position.
USS Nimitz. Admiral, something is wrong here, Toland said quietly.
What might that be?
Baker liked the way things were going. Enemy bomber tracks were being wiped off his screen just as the war games had predicted they would.
The Russians are coming in dumb, sir.
So?
So this far the Soviets have not been very dumb. Admiral, why aren't the backfires going supersonic? Why one attack group? Why one direction?
Fuel constraints, Baker answered. The Badgers are at the limit of their fuel. They have to come in direct.
But not the backfires.
The course is right. The raid count is right.
Baker shook his head and concentrated on the tactical plot. The second squadron of fighters had just launched. Unable to get a head-on shot, their missile accuracy suffered somewhat. They killed 34 targets with 48 missiles. There had been 157 targets plotted. The third and fourth Tomcat squadrons arrived together and launched as a group. When their Phoenixes had been fully expended, 19 targets were left. The two fighter squadrons moved in to engage the remaining targets with their cannon.
Clipper Base, this is Sam Boss. We're going to have some leakers. Recommend we start lighting up SAM radars.
Roger, Sam Boss. Permission granted, answered the group tactical warfare coordinator.
North Atlantic.
I have air search radars bearing 037, the Bear ESM officer noted.
They have detected us. Recommend we illuminate also.
The Bear lit off its big bulge look-down radar.
USS Nimitz.
New radar contact. Designate Raid 2.
What? Snapped Baker.
Next came a call from the fighters.
Clipper Base, this is Slugger Lead. I have a visual on my target.
The squadron commander was trying to examine the target on his long-range TV camera. When he spoke, the anguish in his voice was manifest.
Warning! Warning! This is not a Badger! We've been shooting at Celt missiles!
Raid 2 is 73 aircraft, bearing 217, range 130 miles. We have a big bulge radar tracking the formation, said the CIC talker.
Toland cringed as the new contacts were plotted.
Admiral, we've been had.
The group tactical warfare officer was pale as he toggled his microphone.
Air warning red. Weapons free. Threat axis is 217. All ships turn as necessary to unmask batteries.
The Tomcats had all been drawn off, leaving the formation practically naked. The only armed fighters over the formation were Foch's 8 Crusaders, long since retired from the American inventory. On a terse command from their carrier, they went to afterburner and rocketed southwest toward the backfires.
Too late.
The Bear already had a clear picture of the American formations. The Russians could not determine ship type, but they could tell large from small, and identify the missile cruiser Ticonderoga by her distinctive radar emissions. The carriers would be close to her. The Bear relayed the information to her consorts. A minute later, the 70 backfire bombers launched their 140 AS-6 Kingfish missiles and turned north at full military power.
The Kingfish was nothing like the Celt. Powered by a liquid-fuel rocket engine, it accelerated to 900 knots and began its descent, its radar homing head tracking on a pre-programmed target area 10 miles wide. Every ship in the center of the formation had several missiles assigned.
"Vampire! Vampire!" the CIC talker said aboard Ticonderoga. "We have numerous incoming missiles. Weapons free."
The group anti-air warfare officer ordered the cruiser's Aegis weapons system into full automatic mode. Tycho had been built with this exact situation in mind. Her powerful radar computer system immediately identified the incoming missiles as hostile and assigned each a priority of destruction. The computer was completely on its own, free to fire on its electronic will at anything diagnosed as a threat. Numbers, symbols, and vectors paraded across the master tactical display. The fore and aft twin missile launchers trained out at the first targets and awaited the orders to fire. Aegis was state-of-the-art, the best SAM system yet devised. But it had one major weakness. Tycho carried only 96 SM-2 surface-to-air missiles. There were 140 incoming Kingfish. The computer had not been programmed to think about that. Aboard Nimitz, Toland could feel the carrier heeling into a radical turn. Her engines advanced to flank speed, driving the massive warship at over 35 knots. Her nuclear-powered escorts, Virginia and California, were also tracking the Kingfish, their own missiles trained out on their launchers. The Kingfish were at 8,000 feet, 100 miles out, covering a mile every 4 seconds. Each had now selected a target, choosing the largest within their fields of view. Nimitz was the nearest large ship, with her missile ship escorts to her north. Tycho launched her first quartet of missiles as the targets reached a range of 99 miles. The rockets exploded into the air, leaving a trail of pale gray smoke. They had barely cleared the launch rails when the mounts went vertical and swiveled to receive their reloads. The load and fire time was under 8 seconds. The cruiser would average one missile fired every 2 seconds. Just over 3 minutes later, her missile magazines were empty. The cruiser emerged from the base of an enormous gray arch of smoke. Her only remaining defenses were her gun systems. The SAMs raced in at their targets with a closing speed of over 2,000 miles per hour, directed in by the reflected waves of the ship's own fire control radars. At a range of 150 yards from their targets, the warheads detonated. The Aegis system did quite well. Just over 60% of the targets were destroyed. There were now 82 incoming missiles, targeted on a total of 8 ships. Other missile-equipped ships joined the fray. In several cases, 2 or 3 missiles were sent for the same target, usually killing it. The number of incoming vampires dropped to 70, then 60, but the number was not dropping quickly enough. The identity of the targets was now known to everyone. Powerful, active jamming equipment came on. Ships began a radical series of maneuvers, like some stylized dance, with scant attention paid to station-keeping. Collision at sea was now the least of anyone's worries. When the Kingfish got to within 20 miles, every ship in the formation began to fire off chaff rockets, which filled the air with millions of aluminized mylar fragments that fluttered on the air, creating dozens of new targets for the missiles to select from. Some of the Kingfish lost luck with their targets and started chasing mylar ghosts. 2 of them got lost and selected new targets on the far side of the formation. The radar picture on Nimitz suddenly was obscured. What had been discrete pips designating the positions of ships in the formation became shapeless clouds. Only the missiles stayed constant, inverted V-shapes, with line vectors to designate direction and speed. The last wave of SAMs killed 3 more. The vampire count was down to 41. Toland counted 5 heading for Nimitz. Topside, the final defensive weapons were now tracking the targets. These were the CIWS 20-millimeter Gatling guns, radar-equipped to explode incoming missiles
at a range of under 2,000 yards. Designed to operate in a fully automatic mode, the two after-gun mounts on the carrier angled up and began to track the first pair of incoming kingfish. The portside mount fired first, the six-barrel cannon making a sound like that of an enormous zipper. Its radar system tracked the target and tracked the outgoing slugs, adjusting fire to make the two meet. The leading kingfish exploded 800 yards from Nimitz's port quarter. The 1,000 kilograms of high explosive rocked the ship. Toland felt it, wondering if the ship had been hit. Around him, the CIC crewmen were concentrating frantically on their jobs. One target track vanished from the screen. Four left. The next kingfish approached the carrier's bow and was blasted out of the sky by the forward CIWS too close aboard. Fragments ripped across the carrier's deck, killing a dozen exposed crewmen. Number three was decoyed by a chaff cloud and ran straight into the sea half a mile behind the carrier. The warhead caused the carrier to vibrate and raised a column of water 1,000 feet into the air. The fourth and fifth missiles came in from aft, not 100 yards apart. The after-gun mount tracked on both, but couldn't decide which to engage first. It went into reset mode and petulantly didn't engage any. The missiles hit within a second of one another, one on the afterport corner of the flight deck, the other on the number two arrestor wire. Toland was thrown 15 feet and slammed against a radar console. Next he saw a wall of pink flame that washed briefly over him. Then came the noises. First the thunder of the explosion. Then the screams. The after CIC bulkhead was no longer there. Instead, there was a mass of flame. Men 20 feet away were ablaze, staggering and screaming before his eyes. Toland's only thought was escape. He bolted for the watertight door. It opened miraculously under his hand, and he ran to starboard. The ship's fire suppression systems were already on, showering everything with a curtain of salt water. His skin burned from it as he emerged, hair and uniform singed, to the flight deck catwalk. A sailor directed a water hose on him, nearly knocking him over the side. "Fire in CIC," Toland gasped. "What the hell ain't?" the sailor screamed. Toland fell to his knees and looked outboard. Foch had been to their north, he remembered. Now there was a pillar of smoke. As he watched, the last kingfish was detonated 100 feet over Saratoga's flight deck. The carrier seemed undamaged. 3 miles away, Ticonderoga's after superstructure was shredded and ablaze from a rocket that had blown up within yards of her. On the horizon, a ball of flame announced the destruction of yet another... My God, Toland thought, might that be Saipan? She had 2,000 Marines aboard. "Get forward, you dumbass!" a firefighter yelled at him. Another man emerged to the catwalk. "Toland, you all right?" It was Captain Svensson, his shirt torn away and his chest bleeding from a half-dozen cuts. "Yes, sir," Bob answered. "Get to the bridge. Tell him to put the wind on the starboard beam. Move!" Svensson jumped up onto the flight deck. Toland did likewise, racing forward. The deck was awash in firefighting foam, slippery as oil. Toland ran recklessly, falling hard on the deck before he reached the carrier's island. He was in the pilot house in under a minute. "Captain says put the wind on the starboard beam," Toland said. "It is on the fucking beam," the executive officer snapped back. The bridge deck was covered with broken glass. "How's the skipper?" "Alive. He's aft with a fire." "And who the hell are you?" the XO demanded. "Toland, Group Intel. I was in CIC." "Then you're one lucky bastard. That second bird hit 50 yards from you. Captain got out. Anyone else?" "I don't know, burning like hell." "Looks like you caught part of it, Commander." Bob's face felt as if he'd shaved with a piece of glass. His eyebrows crumpled to his touch. "Flash burns, I guess. I'll be okay. What do you want me to do?" The XO pointed to Toland's water wings. "Can you con the ship?" "Okay, do it. Nothing left to run into anyway.
I'm going aft to take charge of the fire. Communications are out, radar's out, but the engines are okay and the hull's in good shape. Mr. Bice has the deck. Mr. Toland has the con, XO announced as he left.